Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. One of history's great love stories, coupled with some deep philosophical and theological ruminating, all run through James Carroll's new novel, The Cloister, which is out today. The historical novel follows the famous romance between Peter Abelard and Heloise in 12th century France, and a post-World War II friendship between a fictional priest and a woman who survived a Nazi concentration camp. The book raises various questions about faith, love, and identity. James Carroll's the author of 12 novels, 8 works of nonfiction, and he's a former Catholic priest. He joins us now. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much, Deborah. Glad to be here.
So what inspired you to write this novel?
Well, how to answer that? Let me start with the present moment.
Mm.
We live in a moment when we in the West are cursed with the idea that violence is virtuous. Violence is built into the human condition, I know, but in Western culture, Christendom especially, the great tradition of Christianity, an idea took hold of the Western imagination that violence can be the will of God. This novel begins with that idea. God wills it was the motto of the Crusades. Peter Abelard and Heloise, to whom you just referred in the introduction, are at the center of the novel. They lived during the time of the First into the Second Crusade, when this idea was gripping the Western imagination. Peter Abelard has been a figure in my own imagination for decades. I grew up during the Vietnam War years. Peter Abelard is a person who said no to the idea that God wills violence. And that's what made him first important to me. His romance with Heloise, of course, is what made him a legend in the West. They are the Romeo and Juliet of France, in a way. Their letters are some of the great love literature of Western culture. Mm. But what was important to me was they stood together at a fork in the road. And at that fork, Christendom, the West, the church, our culture, took a wrong turn down the road of sacred violence that led ultimately to the wars against Islam, which continue, and also to the deep, violent antagonisms toward Jews, which culminated, of course, in the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. So it's a medieval story, but it's of interest to us because of its legacy in the present day.
Remind us a little bit, though, about some of, you know, what they stood up to at that time and what they were facing and who they were, really, how they met. Some folks might not know this story.
Yeah, well, Peter Abelard was the greatest teacher in Europe. He was the most famous. Hard to figure a contemporary person, but he was the most famous thinker and teacher. He was at the what became the University of Paris. It was the cathedral school at Notre Dame, the cathedral in Paris, the very place that on which the present-day cathedral stands. And students came from all over Europe to study with him. He was a brilliant, charismatic thinker. The canon of the cathedral, the man in charge, the cleric, and Peter Abelard himself was a cleric, asked him to take on as a private pupil his niece, 18, 19, 20 years old, we don't know for sure, Heloise. Peter Abelard took her on as his pupil. He was probably around 40. They fell in love. They had a great romance. It came to a quick and tragic end when Heloise's uncle learned about their romance. He had thugs attack Abelard. Abelard was castrated. Abelard effectively went into the monastery in exile. Heloise exiled herself in a convent. They became a monk, a nun. And then that's when their story began, because that's when they began to exchange these letters that we have. Letters from the early 12th century, written in Latin. It was before the language of French really had taken hold in the culture. And they are some of the most powerful expressions of human longing, human regret, human affirmation. Heloise herself, one of the great figures of our culture, a woman unashamed, strong, standing up to him and to the whole culture. Together they stood against the waves of sacred violence that swept over Europe and the church at that moment. So that's, in a nutshell, their story. She is faithful to him right to the end. His rejection of the prevailing violent theology led to his being condemned at a church council, condemned as a heretic, hounded to death, in effect. She took his remains to her convent, where she was the abbess by then, one of the great figures in the church in Europe. She buried him on the grounds of her abbey. And then 20 years later, when she died, she was entombed with him. Their remains are said to have been brought to Paris in the early 19th century. And if you go into the Père Lachaise Cemetery in the heart of Paris today, you'll find a great, beautiful mausoleum tomb where the remains of Abelard Nelouise are said to reside, one of the great stories of France. So that's a long-winded way of saying an old theological story with profound contemporary relevance.
Right. But you pair this story with the story of a post-World War II priest,
yes,
who befriends a docent at the,
yes,
Cloisters Museum in New York, actual,
right,
museum in New York, and who's a Nazi concentration camp survivor. And so then,
right,
you bring these stories of Abelard and Heloise alive through this friendship as well. And,
right,
why do it that way? Why did you decide that that was the way you wanted to do it?
Well, I knew I wanted a contemporary story to bring home the relevance of this medieval story. And, of course, the Holocaust is the great revelation in the West of this deep current of the consequences of sacred violence, the idea that God wills, in a particular way, the death of Jews. A perversion, of course. Nazi anti-Semitism was a perversion of Christian anti-Judaism. I don't mean to equate the two, but Nazi anti-Semitism couldn't have happened without being prepared for by religious anti-Judaism in the church. That idea that Abelard stood against, well, where did it go? What did it lead to? What is the ultimate consequence of the notion that God has rejected the Jews and that Christians can feel justified in attacking them? Well, frankly, it comes to the Holocaust. So it was and this has been a kind of haunting theme of mine my whole adult life. I've written 20 books. Half of them have dealt with this question. It was very clear to me that this story had to somehow engage with the Holocaust. The priest in this story, Father Michael Cavanaugh, works in an Irish Catholic working class parish in the upper tip of Manhattan. He's naive. He's a man who comes into this history, comes in even in 1950, comes in even into a full recognition of what the church's relationship to the Holocaust was. And he's brought into that reckoning by his encounter with this woman, Rachel Vedette, who had been imprisoned in the Nazi camp in Drancy in Paris, whose father died there, and who was traumatized there in ways that are not resolved until, oddly enough, she encounters this priest. And together, they begin to reckon with unresolved and unanswered questions, each in their own way, each in different ways. But together, they come to a fuller reckoning of who they are and who they want to be. And for both of them, a confrontation with the story of Abelard and Heloise is pivotal.
I guess I wonder, you know, why do this in it? You've mentioned you've written 20 books.
I think at least.
Do this in the form of a novel? What is it about the novel that lets you get at certain truths here that you wouldn't be able to in another form of writing?
Well, fiction does enable us to get at deep truths differently than works of nonfiction. I am a fiction writer. It's how I began my life as a writer. It's a kind of native language for me. I could have written a simple biography of Abelard or another rendition of the story of Abelard and Heloise, but I wanted to reckon with the relationship between the issues they confronted and the issues we confront today. And unless I was going to write a long polemical political essay, that was going to be almost impossible for me to do. Mm-hmm. By telling a story, inventing characters who have a problem and who pursue a solution to their problem, I'm able to, in effect, deal with my own problem. My own problem as a Catholic, believing Catholic, has long been, how did my church get corrupted in such a way as to be complicit in the Holocaust? A separate but related question is, how did my own church get corrupted in such a way that so many figures of the clergy could abuse children and be protected by bishops?
And your book brings up the whole clergy abuse and protecting abusers.
It's true. It has to be an issue in this story because it's related.
Right.
The power structure that the church created for itself in the name of God has an inhuman aspect that must be confronted. We've learned that the hard way now in relation to the sex abuse crisis. We should have learned it more fully a generation and a half ago in relationship to the church's failure during the Holocaust. Mm. As a Catholic, these are deep, deep issues that go to the core of who I am. By writing a story, creating characters who are not myself, but who are grappling with the same questions, I discovered the freedom to pursue the questions wherever they lead. And the truth is, they may lead to places that I myself would be reluctant to go because the characters begin to take charge of the story and I follow it where they tell me to follow it. That's both the pleasure and the challenge of being a novelist.
You know, we've spoken with you
yes.
quite a bit about the clergy abuse crisis here, and you wrote recently in The New Yorker about the death of Cardinal Bernard Law when he died late last year. And you said that, if I have a little paragraph of it here, you said Law's attempt to bind the deadly secret failed. At a time when the voices of women especially resolutely refused to be silenced, the Catholic hierarchy's own attempt to keep the secret of its sexualized power will fail too. Law, despite himself, was the harbinger of the coming truth.
It's true, and the emphasis there is on the role of women.
Right.
Women are leading the church's reckoning with its deep corruption. Women must be more fully brought into power structures in the church. The failure to ordain women is an absurd and blatant example of ongoing church bigotry toward women, misogyny. That's not unrelated to the fact that the two most powerful characters in the novel I've written are women. Eloise herself, mm-hmm. who in effect makes Abelard be Abelard. She calls him to the fray, challenges him to speak the truth as he sees it, which is a truth that runs counter to the crusading truth, the violent God truth that is sweeping through the imagination of the church at that moment. With Eloise prodding him, he challenges that idea and goes on the record for us against it. So the great meaning of the Abelard-Eloise story is this history of the last 1,000 years of Christendom culminating in the Holocaust could have gone another way. And once we understand that it could have gone another way, we realize it can go another way yet going forward. So Eloise is a key figure in this, and so is Rachel Vidette, the woman who is the docent in the cloisters, the museum of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, who is a Holocaust survivor, but who has come out of her experience seared with a clear, crystal clear grasp of the truth of the meaning of the abuse of power, the meaning of the abuse of religion, the meaning of cultural prejudice and where it leads. And her searing grasp of that truth is what staggers Father Michael Cavanaugh in relationship to this woman. It's as if the illusions which he's embraced are burned away and his life has to change.
Right. I'm wondering, though, do you think, though, that the Catholic Church, I mean, it almost seems, you know, immune to change, if you will, right? I mean, this is what you're grappling with. This is what
yes.
the storyline that you're looking at in this book, and you're saying, my church, it could go one way or the other, but it tends to go this way, and it really bothers me when it goes this way, and we aren't, as a church, letting go of that violent past, and we're hanging on to that power structure that allows these things to happen. Is that going to change?
Well, if I actually believed that, Deborah, I wouldn't be a Catholic anymore. How could I?
Well, that's what I'm asking,
I see a profound change underway in the church. Right now, we're living through it. It seems slow and unsteady and one step forward, two steps back. But that's the way an institution like this does change. The most important change in the, not just in my lifetime, but in, I would argue, in the history of Christianity, took place at the Second Vatican Council when the igniting charge against the Jewish people that generated centuries of anti-Jewish violence, that they were the Christ killers, that charge was renounced. That charge is embedded in the Gospels, Deborah. That's not just doctrine. That's not just saying divorced people can't go to communion. This is much more profound than any of the stuff we Catholics argue about normally. We're saying God has not turned God's face against the Jewish people. For most of 2,000 years, that was solid Catholic belief. The Second Vatican Council said no to that. That's the beginning of the dismantling of this power structure. The other thing the Second Vatican Council did is it turned the just war church into a peace church. The Roman Catholic Church, on a dime, in reaction to its own failure during the Holocaust, has renounced its own commitment to solving a political conflict through violence. I can't tell you how important that change is. These other things that we mostly argue about, sexual morality, the place of women in whether they can be ordained or not, all of these things are secondary importance compared to these much larger things. So the vision that Peter Abelard had, a peace church, Jesus Christ, not the warrior at the end of the world, but the Prince of Peace, that vision can reform, reconstitute, reinvent the Catholic imagination. And it's happening. So 100 years from now, there will be women priests. 100 years from now, the power structure of the church will be dismantled in some important way. It's underway. Can I guarantee it? No, of course not. But it's a vital, lively hope. And there are plenty of ways to see the possibility of it unfolding right before us, not the least of which is the arrival 5 years ago this month of Pope Francis.
So you know, I'd like to bring that up because I did just read a poll about Pope Francis. I know it's a poll, but, you know, it shows that he's very popular, even among people who are not Catholic. But it also says that there seems to be an increasing number of Catholics who are very concerned that there is this divide of conservative and liberals, and that perhaps he's taking things too far for what many people might consider comfortable.
Yes.
So is he the face of reform? And, of course, the whole current controversy about what happened in Chile,
yes, that's true.
Over the clergy abuse crisis there, you know, is Pope Francis really reform? And what gives you the satisfaction that the answer to that is yes?
Well, two large questions there. One about Francis himself, the other about the division in the church. Let me take that second one first.
Okay.
The church, the Catholic Church, Christianity in general, is a human institution. So there should be no surprise that there's a division in it. We think of it right now as a right-left division. But the church has been divided against itself from the beginning. We see that in the records of the foundational documents, the Gospels. St. Peter and St. Paul had a ferocious argument rendered in the Gospels and the Acts of the Apostles. There was a ferocious argument over the place of Jews in relationship to the people of Jesus. The church has been arguing with itself about Jews and its relationship to the Jewish people from the beginning. No surprise that that should be happening now. There are these other questions embedded in that big question. The place of women has been controversial in the church from the beginning, which is why you see a lot of confusion in the New Testament about the role of Mary Magdalene, who was the most intimate partner of Jesus. She was his most trusted friend. She was the one to whom Jesus is said to have appeared first. She was one of the few, the only people who didn't abandon Jesus in his hour of need were women. The church has downplayed that, but you can see that tension right there in the beginning. So the division is there. It's lively. That just means that we are a human institution and we resolve things not by obliterating our antagonist, violence, the will of God. No, by working through our disagreements, sometimes with fierce argument, always with civility, always with charity, one hopes. And that's the importance of Francis. He represents that. It isn't that Francis is immune from corruptions of the church. He's a man of the church. Of course he's reflecting them. He made a terrible mistake a month ago when he sided with the bishop in Chile instead of with the victim who was accusing the bishop. Mm. That was a terrible mistake. I think Francis, he was called on it, not incidentally, by Cardinal Law. I mean, I beg your pardon, by Cardinal O'Malley.
Mm-hmm.
Francis shows signs of having regretted his mistake and is moving now to correct it. We've already seen, I would argue, a profound level of change from Francis. He has emphasized the experience of human beings over doctrinal rigidity. That's the meaning of his "Who am I to judge?" For a person of his position to have become kind of symbolized by that phrase is itself a signal of the change.
All right. Well, you know, we could talk for a very long time, but we don't have it, so we'll have to invite you back.
It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you so much. James Carroll's the author of 12 novels and 8 works of nonfiction. His new book, The Cloister, is out today. He'll be talking about it tonight at the Harvard Bookstore. For more information, go to radioboston.org. Stay with us. There is more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.